This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Just going to parachute it from drones overhead, which I'm totally looking forward to.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Amazon Bookstore of Education Policy, David Griffith.
Thank you, Mike. Happy to be here.
Do you know what I'm referring to? Big news. Amazon has built its first ever brick and mortar bookstore.
No
way.
This
one is in Seattle. Yes. And I just think, you know, it's about changing roles here. You know, you're usually the pinch hitter for the research minute, but now you're here as a co-host. And Amazon, you know, we think we order stuff online. Now they're going to do something in person, brick and mortar. Everything's just mixing up here, David. Everything. The lines are blurring.
Indeed. Yeah, I guess it's like blended learning, right? It's blended bookselling.
Yeah, blended bookselling. It seems strange to me that Amazon would go in this direction. I'm not quite sure if this is just, I don't know, some kind of experiment. It seems like they're going in the other direction where, you know, pretty soon they're not even going to have people delivering stuff to your home. They're just going to parachute it from drones overhead, which I'm totally looking forward to. That is going to provide endless entertainment to my kids. I think I'll end up ordering stuff just for the entertainment value of having them get to watch the drone deliver the package.
That sounds like a good plan.
But I digress. David, we are going to have a special edition here of the Education Gadfly Show. Last week, it was a special edition that mostly focused on NAEP. This one, we are going to mostly focus on charter schools. We love us some charter schools. So, Clara, let's get started. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Eva Moskowitz's Success Academy's charter schools are under fire for allegedly suspending students at a very high clip and counseling out chronically disruptive children. Eva says that success isn't for everyone. Is what she's doing okay?
David, you go first, and then I'll tell you why you're wrong, but go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to say yes, but it's a qualified yes.
That it's okay what she's doing.
Yes. So I have more of a problem with the suspensions than I do with the counseling out.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I think ultimately we're imposing a lot of, essentially the entire burden of disruptive students on poor kids. And I don't have a problem with allowing some poor kids to escape that environment, which is essentially what they're doing. On the other hand, I have a little bit more of a problem with using suspension frequently because I think it's just ultimately a short-term measure. And if suspension is being used as a way of signaling to students or families that maybe this isn't the best place for them, I have to believe there's a better way to do that. Mm-hmm. So I frankly can't judge from here what they're doing, but that's my take. What do you think?
Interesting, David. I didn't know where you'd come down on this. Look, on the suspensions point, I understand. Look, I don't like to second guess educators from far away. Eva says it's part of their strategy. Sometimes early in the school year, they'll suspend some kids who are new to the school to send a message to be clear to them and to their family that, hey, we're not playing around here. We really mean it when we talk about these behavioral standards. And I think this is why parents love Eva and her schools, is that she actually walks the talk and she enforces the standards and doesn't just, talk about them. Look, the counseling out, even in the charter school world, a lot of charter people are like, oh my God, you know, we have to serve everybody. We have to, you know, serve the toughest cases too. I understand that impulse. I do. And we, of course, need to worry about the kids who come to school and are disruptive, many of whom I'm sure are going through all kinds of horrendous things at home and that are causing them to act out in various ways. However, as you said, David, we also have to worry about their peers. And when we're talking about schools full of poor kids, right, the peers are other poor kids who simply are not going to have a chance to succeed and achieve if their classrooms are constantly disruptive, if they're feeling unsafe, you know. And so we've got to at least put their needs, they've at least got to be as a higher priority as their disruptive peers need to be. And the public schools, for a variety of reasons, have not been willing to do that or able to do that, politics, whatever. So if you got to, you know, if they're not able to do it, then if the charter sector can do it, I am okay with that too. Okay, topic number two.
A recent Credo report found that students in online charter schools are learning very little, on average losing almost a whole year in math every year. What's the fix here?
I loved Mackie Raymond, who was the author of this study and, you know, the head of Credo. And she said, well, it's not true to say that these kids aren't learning anything. They're just learning very little. that was telling. You know, almost everybody agrees that these online charter schools are by and large stinking it up. A few people out there, mostly people who are, you know, in some way related to the online charter industry, are trying to defend this, saying the study's not fair. It's hard to compare kids and online learning and other approaches. You know, my view, it certainly should be an option out there for kids, but I think what we've learned is, not surprisingly, it doesn't work for everybody. It takes a special kid and probably a special situation in the home to make online schools work effectively. And so, again, back to the same lesson as before, not every school is a good fit for every kid.
Yeah, I think what's tough about this sort of thing, right, is that they're within that sample, right? Even though on average, online schools are doing worse, there's some kids within that group who are doing better as a result of going to online schools.
Really?
Well, there have to be a few, right?
Maybe there's a few.
And so I'm not sure that we should, you know, the answer isn't to say, well, no, nobody can go to online schools. I do think that, you know, though, if we're going to spend taxpayer money on sending kids to these places, then we have to demand some sort of return. Yeah, so
that's right. I mean, look, some of these are getting horrendous results, and they say, oh, but these are kids who are highly mobile, or they've been bullied at school, or they got health issues, or da 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 da. Look, okay, but we hear that same, you know, you can make those same excuses in other schools. I mean, I get it. Some of these kids, you know, it's a legitimate need. Here's an idea, David. How about this? I think for the online sector, it might make sense to go to performance-based funding and say, okay, we will pay you at the end of the school year for every kid that makes a reasonable amount of growth, right? That'll do two things. One, it incentivizes greater performance. Number two, it also incentivizes them not to recruit kids that are unlikely to do well in this model. And I think in this case, that is not an issue of creaming. That's actually an issue of these folks having the right incentives. Right now, their incentive is to sign up all kinds of kids, no matter what, even kids they know are not going to have the support at home to be successful and get the public funding for it. I think we need to flip those incentives.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, Mike. I think the odds of you know, these online charters successfully creaming the best students from brick and mortar schools are low. Yeah. So I don't have any problem with that incentive. Good
All
idea.
All right. Hey, thanks. All right. Okay. Topic number three, Clara.
The Obama administration has announced a pilot program to allow high school students to access Pell Grants for dual enrollment opportunities on college campuses. Is this a smart idea?
You know, David, we don't do a lot of higher ed around here, but this is a big deal. I mean, Pell Grants, they've forever been just for accredited institutions of higher education.
Yep.
And now to say that high school students can get access to them, this is basically a voucher, by the way, at the high school level. It's a small pilot program at first, 10,000 kids. Is this worth celebrating?
Sure. Why not? I don't have a problem with it. As long as the kids are ready for the material, which I guess is the assumption we're making here, or maybe we shouldn't make it. I don't know. But I think I see no reason why we shouldn't try this, at least.
I love what you just said, David, because let's play this out, right? It makes sense. You say, look, okay, can we have a way to figure out that this only goes to kids who are ready to take college courses? Well, what if we did that for kids who had already graduated from high school, right? Well, what would you find? A whole lot of Pell Grants right now are going to support the education of kids who are not ready for college, who end up in remedial education. Look, I think there's a grand bargain to be made here, and it's something around saying, hey, Pell Grants should go for kids who are ready for college, even if they're ready earlier than other kids. But it should not be going to kids who are not ready for college. It should not be going to remedial education, at least kids who are way, way, way under below that college ready level. Again, because we know those kids are not going to get through remedial education. They're not going to succeed. Most of them are going to drop out. Look, I think community colleges are just as bad as the for-profit colleges here, where, again, they go in and they take in kids. It's just like the online charters. They take in kids that are not ready, who are not going to succeed. They know they're not going to succeed, but they take their money, or they take the public money. Anyway, I think we stop that, and then we can spend more money for kids in high school that are ready to get started.
So you're for it?
I'm for it.
Okay.
And look, hey, let's give the administration some credit. We don't always say nice things about the Obama administration. You know, 7 years on, they're getting a little long in the tooth, you know. But this one seems like a cool idea. It looks like they've been pretty thoughtful about putting it together. It'll be fun to watch. All right. On that upbeat note, that is all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now time for everyone, and I mean everyone's favorite segment, Amber's Research Minute. Amber's Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
All righty. We are having a special charter school edition, or at least mostly charter school edition of the Education Gadfly. And I understand that you're going to continue that right into the research minute.
I am. I'm going to do a little self-promo. We at Fordham have a new report out this week called Is Detente Possible? District Charter School Relations in Four Cities.
Wait, was this an MBER, as I recall?
Not exactly, Mike. But,
but you know why? Because they would not publish our study with a cover on it, and this cover is awesome. It's got Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. But anyways, I digress.
Shaking hands, you digress and interrupt my minute. But anyway, authors by analysts at Public Impact, we work with those guys. It's a case study of how these relationships play out in Boston, Washington, D.C., Cleveland, and Denver. Okay, a few questions we wanted to know: how are districts engaging with charters? Why do they choose to engage with them? And is this producing any results at all? Okay, as for question number one, how engagement is occurring, the authors found that the two sectors partner in an effort to improve communications and improve instructional practice. So, fine, it's well and good. It's not like really intense stuff. Deeper engagement, however, is not occurring. So, in other words, we don't see districts sharing resources with charters. Imagine that.
Yep.
We don't see them like saying, here's all our local levy dollars. Have at it. We don't see them giving them facilities and that kind of stuff. We don't see them, you know, working together to site new schools, like where should the school go? So all that kind of thing. But they're doing something. It's just not like, you know, hugely meaningful stuff, right?
Yeah.
As to why they engage, the takeaway is, I think, common sense, that districts and charters generally maintain their distance until and unless they find it in their own interest to reach out. That's not rocket science, right?
Yeah.
For instance, in Cleveland, the threat of a state takeover pushed the mayor to undertake bold reform that included incentives for high-performing charters to align with the district.
Mm-hmm.
And in D.C., charter market share reached a tipping point by which the district and the charter sector were prompted to help navigate the two sectors for families who were enrolling in schools and whatnot. One of the other findings is that districts need skin in the game to prompt them to engage. So, for instance, when districts have a stake in charter success, when they authorize charter schools, when the district's report card includes the charters it authorizes in their scores, that kind of thing, when you have that baked in incentive, they're obviously going to be more likely to engage. And then finally, our last question, does this matter? Do we see any improvement at all? Really hard question to parse in any study, but in this one, we had a few examples. One, charters and district leaders both say they report having better relationships than previously. Cities and districts are hiring former charter leaders for key positions, which we didn't used to see. There are some examples of lower operational costs. Some improved services have emerged. And at least in Denver, we see high-performing charters are replacing low-performing district schools. So there are some nuggets there. Last thing I'll mention is that one of the coolest things, right, is the metaphor that Public Impact came up with to describe these cities. They use this foreign, you know, relations metaphor, which is what you're talking about with the cover. So, for instance, D.C. is a superpower summit because you got these two sort of sectors that are similar size and influence working together, but neither side has any intention of allowing the other to, you know, trump on their interests. So, hey, it's an interesting report. It's a qualitative case study, but it's got a lot of rich information. And yes, that's my promo to read it.
Yes, and it is a great report and a great read and a lot of really interesting stuff going on in there. I mean, look, you do find some things you might not know about, that there is some efforts at collaboration. It tends to be fairly shallow. But what we say, again, on this foreign policy metaphor here, foreign relations metaphor, is that even some of these shallow efforts, the symbolic efforts, hey, if they keep the pot from boiling over, right? If they keep people from, you know, kind of, you know, just being at each other's throats,
right,
that's a good thing, right?
It is a
and
good
so
thing.
Even if it's just about keeping peace while each sector does its thing, it's certainly worth celebrating. Now, we just shouldn't be, you know, naive to expect that it's going to lead to, you know, really serious integration or collaboration, or as people used to talk about, co-opetition.
Right.
You know, that this
ew.
Just, yeah, exactly. Very ew. But, you know, it's just not in their interest to do that.
Right. And that's where I think where we started with. David's been on this project with me, you know, helping to shape it and give feedback to Public Impact. And I think we started with this idea that, like, why would they do it in the first place? Why? How is it in their best interest? And we ended up there, what, a year and a half later with that as our same takeaway.
Yeah, I think to me, the most interesting part is when we try to think about how we can change the incentives. And I don't think we have have that completely nailed, but we do have a few interesting ideas, which is why you should read the report. But, you know, it is. It's common sense. They're not going to work together in a really deep way unless we can give them a reason to. So getting, you know, kind of maybe tweaking the incentives around, you know, facilities or performance to try and incentivize that is worth trying, I think, because this issue is obviously not going away anytime soon. So,
all right. Well done, guys. And thanks especially toward the team at Public Impact who did such a nice job on this one.
Yes.
All right. Well, that is all the time we've got this week. Until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.